President Trump now says he'll postpone delivering his State of the Union address until the government shutdown is over. Today is Thursday, January 24th. This is WBUR's Morning Edition. Good morning, I'm Bob Oakes. Coming up, the president's decision to delay the State of the Union planned for next week. House Speaker Pelosi officially rescinded her invitation because of the shutdown, now in day 34. Today, the Senate votes on two bills aimed at ending the shutdown, both expected to fail. Also, in Venezuela, the arguments over who is the rightful president. And this hour, Governor Baker lays out his new state budget plan, including a big boost for education.
We're filing a multi-year school finance reform initiative, which will increase funding for school districts to invest in a quality education for every child.
Sports, Celtics beat the Cavs. Forecast, heavy rain coming today. It'll be in the 50s. It's 7:01. Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump says he'll wait until the partial federal government shutdown is over to deliver his State of the Union address. NPR's Matthew Schwartz says the partial shutdown is more than a month old.
The on-again, off-again, on-again State of the Union is off again. President Trump made the announcement late Wednesday night. For several days, Trump and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi have been sparring over whether to postpone the address. As recently as Wednesday afternoon, Pelosi told Trump he definitely couldn't deliver the address from the House floor. The president responded that he would just do the speech somewhere else. Now Trump appears to have changed his mind. "I will do the address when the shutdown is over," he said on Twitter. He said he's not looking for an alternative venue because there is no venue that can, quote, compete with the history, tradition, and importance of the House chamber. The shutdown has now entered day 34 and shows no signs of stopping. Matthew Schwartz, NPR News.
Votes are scheduled today in the Senate on two bills to end the partial government shutdown. One includes the money that President Trump wants for a border wall. Neither bill is expected to pass. The Transportation Security Administration is looking for officers to volunteer to move temporarily to airports where staffing levels have dropped due to the partial government shutdown. As NPR's David Shaper reports, it's a sign that the shutdown is beginning to put a greater strain on airport security.
The TSA confirms that volunteers are needed to leave their home airports and go fill in for absent officers at other airports to help minimize the shutdown's impact on airport security. 10% of officers scheduled to work last Sunday called out, with many of them saying that they could not report to work due to financial limitations. That led some airports to close lanes and consolidate checkpoints, resulting in longer wait times than usual for travelers to get through security. The percentage of officers calling out has dropped a bit the last couple of days, but staffing shortages are worse at some airports than others, so the TSA is trying to move officers around to fill in the gaps. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
Embattled Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has told U.S. diplomats to get out of his country within 72 hours. But the Trump administration is ignoring him. The U.S. says it recognizes opposition leader Juan Guaido as the interim president of Venezuela. Guaido took the oath of office yesterday as anti-government protests occurred in Venezuelan cities, including the capital, Caracas. Officials from the Organization of American States will hold an emergency meeting in Washington, D.C. today. They'll take up the Venezuela situation. The Venezuelan opposition may try to demand that it be seated in place of the delegate from President Nicolas Maduro's government. Several countries still say they support Maduro. That includes Russia, China, and Turkey. You're listening to NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good morning. I'm Bob Oakes in Boston. A flash flood watch is in effect for nearly all of Massachusetts today, with an inch or two of rain expected by this afternoon. With leftover snow and ice still blocking some storm drains, street flooding is also expected. State Emergency Management Agency spokesman Chris Bessie has advice for people who might see high water on the roads.
Just turn around, don't drown because of the hazard of flooded roadways. Even 6 inches or a foot of water can sometimes cause cars to stall out, depending on the car and the drainage.
We'll have the forecast in just a few minutes. In other news, Governor Baker has made education one of the focal points of his nearly $43 billion new state budget plan. Included is $100 million in a trust fund for students entering college this fall. WBUR's Fred Tice reports students could use the money to reduce college costs, get paid for internships, and do college.
co-ops.
$15 million would go to expanding programs that give high school students a jump start on college. Higher Education Commissioner Carlos Santiago says the goal is to lower college costs.
It focuses on initiatives that help students transition from high school to college, and that is in part the early college programs where students take rigorous college courses while they're in high school.
But advocates for more funding for public higher education are disappointed. Zach Bears of the Public Higher Education Network of Massachusetts says the budget does not really address the scope of the funding and cost crisis. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Fred Tice.
The city of Boston is getting top marks for its citywide free preschool program in a new report from the National Institute for Early Education Research. The report examined pre-K programs in 40 of the largest U.S. cities. Boston was one of just five cities to get high scores. Another small college about to close. Green Mountain College in Vermont is the latest in trouble because of declining enrollment and increasing costs. The school alerted students yesterday that this spring semester will be its last. It says students there will be able to continue studying at two other schools. It's 7:06.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Thompson Family Adventures, small group and private family adventures around the world, as seen in Travel and Leisure, familyadventures.com/WBUR. Cityside Subaru on Route 60 in Belmont, providing sales and service of Subaru all-wheel drive vehicles. Wishing you the best winter ever, CitysideSubaru.com. And Tire Rack, with more than 500 tire models from 22 manufacturers, and an online tool for finding tires based on vehicle, needs, budget, and brand. TireRack.com, helping drivers find, deliver, install.
Sports: Celtics beat the Cleveland Cavaliers 123-103 last night at the Garden for their fifth straight win. Celts go for six in a row Saturday when they host Golden State. Traffic: 495 South in Andover. There's a crash in the median before Route 133. Route 1 South slow from Walnut Street to Route 99 and then again getting over the Tobin Bridge. Mazpike eastbound is currently 35 minutes from 495 to 128. Forecast, it'll feel like spring today. Temperatures in the 50s, but with rain. Some heavy rain coming this afternoon. Tonight, the rain stops and it clears. Falls to the 20s tonight. Sunny tomorrow in the 30s. Sunny in the 20s on Saturday. Then sunny in the 40s on Sunday. In Boston now, 52 degrees. 49 in Worcester, 50 in Beverly, and 50 in New Bedford at 7:08.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Here is the state of play in efforts to reopen the federal government. The Senate votes on two bills today. The Republican measure has funding the president demanded for a wall along the border with Mexico, along with some other immigration measures. The Democratic measure just reopens the government. In the House, a leading Democrat, James Clyburn, says his party is ready to give the president all the money he is asking for border security, just not a wall.
If his $5.7 billion is about border security, then we see ourselves fulfilling that request, only doing it with what I like to call using a smart wall.
Republican Mark Meadows sees no change here.
On day one, there was $0 for new border fencing measures. On day 33, there's still $0 for new border fencing measures.
So how's all this look from the White House? Our next guest is Mercedes Schlapp. She is White House Director of Strategic Communications. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Would the president consider that offer, all the money, $5.7 billion, just not a wall?
Well, why don't we have the Democrats come over and propose that over to the president? What we have not seen, sadly, is the Democrats willing to, especially Democrat leadership with Speaker Pelosi, come wanting to negotiate. We have been waiting for a counteroffer. The president last Saturday presented a good faith, reasonable proposal that would immediately reopen the government and as well as provide measures that would secure the border.
Are you, if you'll forgive me, are you saying the president would seriously consider what Clyburn just put on the table there?
What we need is a conversation to happen.
So yes, is that a yes or just coming to?
Is that there? What we need to determine is that their counteroffer. Speaker Pelosi hasn't told us what their counteroffer is. What we know in the president's proposal is that includes several elements that the Democrats would agree with, including an extension of DACA an extension of temporary protected status, and as well as asylum a law that would actually that they would support, which would be that young minors would be able to apply for asylum in their home country. Before, when the president was about to give the address, even before that, Speaker Pelosi put out a statement, and she said that Democrats want stronger, more effective border security. Two of the bullet points she included, which was more immigration judges to deal with the backlog, mm-hmm. and also basically allowing for counter-narcotics technology. Those are two elements that are included in the president's proposal. We are ready to have this discussion with the Democrat leadership. Question is are they going to come to the table?
We should note that Democrats disagree with the way the president has laid out the DACA protections as well as the asylum protections. We'll discuss that another time. But I want to ask about this shutdown because it goes on. It's more than a month old. And the National Air Traffic Controllers Association has put out a statement because, of course, air traffic controllers are affected here. They're not being paid. There's some things they can't do. The statement says, quote, "We cannot even calculate the level of risk currently at play, nor predict the point at which the entire system will break. If a plane crashes and people are killed because of this shutdown, is the wall worth that?"
Well, I will say that at this point, what the president and the speaker, what the president wants to do is have the Democrats come to the table. The Democrats keep delaying the process.
Is a plane crash? The president is the one who's making a demand. Is the wall worth people getting killed?
The Democrats' demand is not going to work because of the fact that they don't even want to have a discussion with the president. The president has asked time and time again to come to a compromise, and they refuse to do so. So we want to open the government. We want the Democrats to come to the table. We want to secure the border where we have seen increased crime, where we have seen increased gang activity, where we have to deal with a decades-old problem. And it's time we have put forward a good faith proposal, and yet we have no answer coming from the Democrats.
We also have DHS leaders, former DHS leaders, five of them, including John Kelly, the former White House chief of staff and the president's DHS secretary, saying that it's unconscionable that Homeland Security workers are not being paid. We have the FBI Agents Association saying that investigations are being hampered. So that leads to another question. If the shutdown leads to a terror attack that gets Americans killed, is the wall worth that? Yes or no?
Again, I'm going to say that the Democrats need to come to the table. We are ready to open this government immediately. We want to be able to secure the border, which is we know is an issue that is incredibly important, especially as our Border Patrol agents have asked for these resources. And so it's time for the Democrats to stop going home, because this is what's happening. Speaker Pelosi will be going home this weekend, will not be in Washington. She is not taking this seriously.
Well, the Senate will be out as well. Why are you uncomfortable answering yes or no to that question?
I think at the end of the day, no one, not any American, thinks that we want a plane to crash, any safety concerns. And that is why the president wants to open up the government, secure our border, have the Democrats come to the table, as opposed to the Democrats continuously going home and not working and not getting to a resolution.
Mercedes Schlepp, thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
She is the White House Director of Strategic Communications. NPR's Domenico Montanaro was listening along with us. Domenico, what did you hear there?
Well, you certainly heard much less about a border wall. There certainly wasn't the idea of, build a wall, crime will fall, as the president talked about yesterday. Instead, when you asked her if the president would accept $5.7 billion or potentially more than that, that Democrats could put on the table as early as today for border security, she said, well, why don't we have the Democrats propose that to the president? Certainly sounds like an openness and a potential way out of this shutdown. At the same time, of course, we don't know inside the mind of the president. We don't know if he will accept that, but it certainly sounds like an opening, Steve.
We should be clear. People close to the president, including the vice president, Mike Pence, have sounded more willing to deal than the president has sounded over the past several weeks.
They are always more willing to deal. They just don't know what the president will exactly sign off on.
Okay. Domenico, thanks for the update. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's Domenico Montanaro.
Faced with an aging population and an acute labor shortage, Japan is doing something previously unthinkable. They're allowing immigration. Critics point out that foreign workers in Japan often face exploitation, and the system that allows them in has to be fixed. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from the city of Koriyama.
Horiyama is part of Fukushima Prefecture, which was devastated by the 2011 earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear meltdown. There's a shelter here for foreign workers. As the wind howls and the snow drifts outside, Vietnamese workers make dinner inside. Among them is a man surnamed Nguyen. He asked that we only use his last name as he doesn't want his family in Vietnam to know what he's been through. Mr. Nguyen came to Japan in 2015 as part of a government program for technical trainees. He signed a contract to get on-the-job training as a rebar worker.
I expected to come to a country more developed, clean, and civilized than my own. In my mind, Japan had many good things, and I wanted to learn professional skills to take home.
Instead, he said he was ordered to do menial jobs, including removing radiation-contaminated topsoil from land around the Fukushima nuclear plant. Nguyen says he wasn't given protective equipment and he wasn't paid in full. He complained to his company, but they ignored him. An added complication was that he had borrowed money to pay a Vietnamese agent who had helped him get to Japan.
I wanted to sue my company, but I didn't know how. I didn't speak Japanese or understand Japan's legal system, so all I could do was be patient and keep working to pay off the debt.
Technical trainees account for about 20% of Japan's 1.3 million foreign workers. Most are from developing countries, including China, Myanmar, and Vietnam. Japanese Labor Ministry data shows most are paid less than the minimum wage. Critics have derided the system as slavery, or human resources minus the humanity. They warn that if the technical trainee program isn't fixed, many of the newcomers could end up exploited like Mr. Nguyen. Speaking to lawmakers last October, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe denied he's opening Japan's door to immigrants.
We are not considering adopting a so-called immigration policy. To cope with the labor shortage, we will expand the current system to accept foreign workers in special fields.
Japan's parliament passed Abe's plan last month after a brief debate. Sasaki Shiro is Secretary General of the Zentoitsu Workers Union, which represents some of the foreign workers. He says that Japan's government is not facing up to the reality of immigration.
Abe's definition of an immigrant is someone who lives in Japan long-term, with family. But by international standards, the trainees are immigrants. In this sense, we can say that Japan is already an immigrant society.
Sasaki says that opening Japan's door to immigrants even a tiny crack is better than tricking them into coming. He says Japan has never experienced mass immigration, and he sees it as a test of character of this island nation.
Japan has never been able to examine itself and define itself in terms of diversity. Now we must live with diversity, and every single Japanese person must think about it.
Then again, Robert Dujarric, director of the Institute of Contemporary Asian Studies at Temple University in Tokyo, argues that Abe may have no choice but to reform by stealth.
Immigration is unfortunately not popular, even in countries like the U.S. or in Western Europe, which historically have been nations that have been built on immigration. So obviously he's not going to say, vote for me, I will bring in 10 million foreigners.
Japan's government says it will crack down on brokers and provide effective oversight to the trainee system. Current trainees, like Mr. Nguyen, may be eligible to remain in the country for up to 5 years on a new class of visas. But Nguyen says that without decent pay and a chance to learn new skills, he has no interest in staying on. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Koriyama, Japan.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Just ahead on Morning Edition, the arguments made in a new essay in The Atlantic making the case for the impeachment of President Trump. Also, a nurse in Arizona arrested in the alleged sex assault of a woman who gave birth to a child, even though the woman has been in a coma since she was a toddler. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Lexus, introducing a new model, the Lexus UX, a luxury subcompact SUV available as a hybrid with all-wheel drive, now available at your local Lexus dealer. And Akamai, providers of their intelligent edge security platform for threat protection that comes with over 300 security researchers. Learn more at Akamai, akamai.com/security. Akamai, intelligent security starts at the edge.
Now the forecast, a very wet day. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
Look for the rain to become steadier and heavier. Temperatures this afternoon get into the mid-50s. That gusty wind could cause some scattered power outages, 1 to 2 inches of rain. Tonight it all comes to end. We clear out, we go down to the 20s. It's sunny on Friday, back to the 30s. Saturday sunshine only in the upper 20s, but Sunday it's in the low 40s with a blend of clouds and sun.
In Boston now, 52 degrees at 720.
If you had to work for more than a month without pay, would you still be able to make ends meet?
My little boy's birthday is Friday. Me and my wife talked about last night, like, what are we going to buy him? You know what I mean?
I'm Ari Shapiro, reporting from Louisiana on the government shutdown's impact on one small town. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered, today from 4 to 6:30 on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR News Station.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Amazon Web Services. Whether it's searching for life on other planets or helping enterprises reinvent their industries, AWS works to help technology scale to meet the challenge. More at awsishow.com. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where physician researchers are working to create vaccines to enable a person's immune system to stop melanoma and other cancers. More at danafarber.org/defeatcancer. And Atlassian, a collaboration software company powering teams around the world, committed to providing the tools and practices to help teams plan, track, build, and work better together. More at Atlassian.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. When Democrats took charge of the House of Representatives, their leaders were clear. They had no intention of starting off with impeachment proceedings. An investigation of President Trump's ties to Russia is not finished. Many Democrats may view the president as unfit for office, but if the House were to impeach him, he would likely survive a trial in the Republican Senate anyway. That has been the thinking of Democratic leaders. Yoni Applebaum views it differently. He is a student of history and a writer for The Atlantic, and he argues an impeachment process could be helpful for the country, for the president's critics, and even, in a way, more fair to the president. What is it you think people are getting wrong about the idea of beginning impeachment proceedings today?
Well, I think most people think of impeachment as an outcome rather than as a process. And so when people debate this question, they're often really debating whether or not they think that Donald Trump ought to be able to continue as president of the United States. I'd rather that Americans approach this as a process, as an utterly rule-bound way to have a debate that is already raging in this country.
No president has ever been impeached by the House of Representatives and then convicted by the Senate and removed from office. The process has never gone all the way through. Therefore, it's pointless. That's one point of view. What's yours?
Well, I'd flip that around, and I'd say that the process has actually worked extraordinarily well on several occasions. And so with the impeachment of Andrew Johnson, which I think is a prime example of this, you've got a president who is remarkably unpopular and yet has a core of extraordinarily loyal supporters.
The guy who took over after Abraham Lincoln was assassinated at the end of the Civil War. Okay.
Right. So his holding that office is of contested legitimacy. He comes from a different political party than Abraham Lincoln does. He clashes with congressional Republicans. And the fight really is over what Johnson calls his urge to preserve a white man's government. He does not wish to see America be a place with any degree of racial equality. Congress passes laws. The president vetoes them. For the first time in American history, we get a veto override of a major piece of legislation. And Congress asks the president to do something that no president has ever done, which is to enforce a law that he has previously vetoed. And Johnson effectively won't do it. And this sets up an enormous power struggle. Congress moves forward with impeachment, and it instantly does, I think, three critical things. One is it diffuses the potential for violence. The second thing it does is it separates the reasonable charges against Johnson from the unreasonable ones. And then the third thing that it does is it took a debate that was unformed and raging in public, and it moves it into Congress And as it does that, it focuses the president's attention on his own political future. Johnson is no longer talking to raucous crowds and calling for the hanging of his political rivals, as he had previously done. Instead, he buttons up a little bit, and he ultimately decides to give Congress its way on Reconstruction. It does not result in Johnson's removal, but it does result in his essential political death.
One pattern of Congress in recent decades has been to outsource its powers or its responsibilities to other people, to set up a commission to try to solve a problem, to let the president handle it while they look the other way. Would you argue that that is what has happened here, that there are members of Congress who don't want to look too closely at the president, it's politically embarrassing, and they are relieved that Robert Mueller is there to perform his own investigation about which they can avoid commenting for as long as possible?
I think there are many members of Congress, I should say of both parties, who believe that this president is fundamentally unfit for office and are hoping for a sort of deus ex Mueller to save them from the constitutional responsibility.
Deus ex Mueller? Is that Latin? I think it is. Go on. I'm sorry.
And that's what they're hoping for. They're hoping that somebody else will come and bail them out here, that if they wait patiently on the sidelines, they won't have to do this hard thing, which is have a process and potentially a divisive one of looking through the evidence and hearing from witnesses. They would rather that Mueller deliver them a gift wrap box, and inside it is all the damning evidence that will force Donald Trump to resign without the need to trigger this process.
Wouldn't impeachment also be hard for the country and the people at large? It's a process that would be enormously divisive, enormously distracting at a moment when we have a lot of things we really should be focusing on.
There's no question that a process of impeachment would be divisive. On the other hand, I think it's very hard to look out at the current political landscape and conclude anything other than that these questions are tearing the country apart. I don't think that this is a process that needs to lead to Donald Trump's removal in order to be healthy for America. What we need at this moment as Americans is a process that can take the passions of the public debate and channel them into an orderly way that will lead to a path toward resolution. If we get that, if Congress takes its responsibilities here seriously, triggers an impeachment inquiry into the president, and weighs and assesses the evidence, then I think wherever that inquiry comes out, America will be better off for Congress having pursued it.
Yoni Applebaum of The Atlantic, thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
A disturbing story out of Arizona to update you on now, related to sexual assault. Phoenix police say they have arrested a nurse at a long-term care facility who allegedly raped a 29-year-old female patient who had been incapacitated for more than two decades. The woman was impregnated as a result of the assault and delivered a baby in December. Kathy Ritchie of member station KJZZ reports.
The story stunned disability advocates and the community at large. A young woman with limited mobility and communication abilities delivered a baby in December, but her caregivers did not know she was pregnant. That included her doctors, both of whom are no longer providing medical services.
And at this time, I am announcing the arrest of the suspect we believe who is responsible. He is 36-year-old Nathan Sutherland.
That's Phoenix Police Chief Jerry Williams.
Sutherland is a licensed practical nurse who was responsible for providing care to the victim during this time the sexual assault occurred.
Through the course of their investigation, Phoenix Police obtained DNA from several individuals who worked at Hacienda Healthcare, including Sutherland. Here's Phoenix Police Sergeant Tommy Thompson.
That evidence was sent to the Phoenix Police Department Crime Lab, and those individuals worked tirelessly to compare those DNA samples with DNA obtained from the baby.
One of those samples belonged to Sutherland. He was booked Wednesday and charged with one count of sexual assault and one count of vulnerable adult abuse. Thompson says the investigation is ongoing. It's unclear if there are other victims or how many times the victim was sexually assaulted. In a statement, Hacienda Healthcare says the alleged perpetrator held a current state of Arizona practical nurse's license and had undergone an extensive background check when he was hired. Hacienda says he was fired after learning of his arrest. Although police have not offered an update on the mother's status, they say the baby is doing well. The family of the birth mother says through their lawyer that they will care for the baby boy. For NPR News, I'm Kathy Ritchie in Phoenix.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Coming up on Morning Edition, we dig into Governor Baker's new state budget plan, which includes sports betting, more money for education, and new taxes on vaping. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by North Shore Medical Center, where spine specialists use surgical and non-surgical treatments to help patients relieve pain and restore mobility. Learn more at nsmc.partners.org. AL Prime Energy Consultant, distributor of wholesale gasoline and diesel fuels for retail and commercial use, alprime.com. And Artist Senior Living of Lexington and Reading, specialized memory care for individuals living with dementia, focused on each person's individuality. ArtistSeniorLiving.com.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump says he'll wait until the partial government shutdown is over to deliver his State of the Union address. NPR's John Stempin reports on the latest back and forth between the president and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
The president had threatened to just show up at the Capitol and give the speech next Tuesday regardless, even if Pelosi ordered the House chamber closed for security reasons she blamed on the partial shutdown. But overnight, Trump tweeted nothing compares to giving the address in the House, and he'll give a great speech in the near future.
Later today, the Senate will be voting on two proposals to end the partial shutdown. Neither is expected to pass. The Trump administration says it's ignoring an order from Venezuela's president for U.S. diplomats to leave that country. NPR's Michelle Kellerman says the U.S. is recognizing a political opposition leader as Venezuela's interim president.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the U.S. stands with the man it sees as the interim president of Venezuela, the leader of the National Assembly, Juan Guaido. While Maduro gave U.S. diplomats 72 hours to leave, Guaido is calling on all diplomatic missions in Venezuela to stay. The U.S., Pompeo says, doesn't recognize Maduro and does not think he has the legal authority to break relations with the U.S.
Anti-government protests in Venezuela yesterday left at least 7 people dead. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good morning. I'm Bob Oakes in Boston. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has delayed a decision on whether to extend the life of the Seabrook nuclear plant in New Hampshire through the year 2050. The agency faced pressure from Massachusetts politicians who wanted more public input before a decision is made. Here's reporter Annie Ropeek.
Members of Congress raised concerns after the NRC said it would approve extending Seabrook's license this month before an adjudicative hearing with a local watchdog group this summer. That hearing will focus on cracks in the plant's concrete foundations. The congressional delegation wanted the license approval delayed until after the hearing, but the NRC hasn't committed to that. They say they will meet with the public separately before moving forward on the new license. That meeting hasn't been scheduled. Seabrook will be one of two nuclear plants in New England after Pilgrim Station closes this year. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Annie Ropeek.
The utility Columbia Gas will pay the city of Lawrence for an extra crew of 3 firefighters for the next 2 months. The Lawrence fire chief requested Columbia pay for the increased staffing following the natural gas fires and explosions in Lawrence last fall. Governor Baker says integrating electric rental scooters into the state transportation system is critical for the future. Baker has filed a bill to treat the dockless scooters like bicycles, forcing riders younger than 16 to wear helmets and requiring operators to yield to pedestrians. The governor also wants the scooters to not go any faster than 20 miles an hour. Traffic, 495 in Marlboro. The exits to Route 20 are closed right now because of a fire nearby. 495 north in Rainham, the right lane is blocked by a crash at Route 24, and 93 south is 40 minutes now from 128 to the Sachem Bridge. Sports, Celtics beat the Cleveland Cavaliers last night, 123-103 at the Garden, so their winning streak is up to 5 games. The Celts host the Golden State Warriors on Saturday. Forecast, rain heavy at times this afternoon, 1 to 2 inches is possible. Highs today, though, in the mid-50s. Clears out tonight, lows down to the 20s. Tomorrow, sunny skies in the mid-30s. Saturday, sunny, only in the 20s. Then Sunday, partly sunny and in the 40s. In Boston now, 52 degrees, 53 in Newton, 51 in Lawrence, and 51 degrees in Brockton at 7:34.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Plymouth Rock Assurance, providing auto insurance for Massachusetts and New Hampshire drivers who like doing business online and having guidance from a local agent. PlymouthRock.com. Zoom. Zoom offers cloud video conferencing, online meetings, and a video conference room solution in one platform, featuring digital video and audio with screen sharing, account registration, and more at zoom.us. And Campaign Monitor, an email marketing platform used by more than 200,000 customers worldwide, with email templates, a drag-and-drop email editor, and 24/7 customer service. More at campaignmonitor.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Good morning. The country is in a state of limbo. It is day 34 of the partial government shutdown, and there are reports the White House is preparing for the possibility that the shutdown could last another 2 months or longer. Meanwhile, 800,000 federal employees are going to miss yet another paycheck tomorrow. We're going to get two views of the shutdown and the impact it's having. First, we head out of Washington, D.C. to the state of Ohio, which is where NPR's Don Gagne has been talking to folks about the shutdown standoff. Hey, Don.
Good morning.
Where are you exactly in Ohio, and what are you hearing?
I am in Chillicothe, Ohio. Columbus is about an hour to the north. This is the part of the state where the map turns red. Maybe not deep, deep, deep red, but red, though in Chillicothe, there are precincts that vote Democratic as well. But people are absolutely watching the shutdown. And the first thing you notice when you ask about it is that the partisan divide holds. You know, we've seen President Trump's poll numbers drop since the shutdown began in December. And Democrats I talk to here say this is all on Trump. His demand for funding the wall leaves no room to negotiate. You talk to Republicans and it gets a little more interesting. They're still with Trump, but it's more complicated. And some will say Democrats have to come to the table, but they also wonder what the White House plan is here.
I mean, as you allude to, Trump did very well in Ohio. He carried the state easily and was really popular exactly where you are. So it would make sense, I suppose, that supporters are standing by him. Is that across the board?
It's they're standing by him when you talk to Republicans. But let me introduce you to some people here. Let's start with Beverly Chapman, a high school English teacher. I talked to her at a shopping mall about a mile from downtown Chillicothe. She is in that category of hardcore Trump supporter, as strong as ever.
I think he's got us on the right track and he's helping out. And
she says it's on the Democrats to make the next step toward reaching a deal that could then reopen the full U.S. government.
They need to get back to the table and start negotiating. You know, I think the Democrats need to work with him.
So that's the solid-as-a-rock Trump base speaking there. But let me give you a different reaction to what's going on from a Trump voter in Chillicothe. Fran Burdett works in a law office. She actually says she was a reluctant Trump vote. She just couldn't pull the lever for Hillary Clinton. She told me that she agrees the U.S. needs a wall to keep people from crossing the border illegally, but she does not think it is the thing to shut the government down over.
But I don't think this is the right way to do it. I mean, you've got to worry about the people first.
And here's what she means by that.
The thing that worries me the most is the people that are not getting paid. And these people are living from paycheck to paycheck, you know, especially like the Coast Guard and different places, people on food stamps, all that kind of stuff. You know, they need help.
One more thing about Burdett. She says she still supports Trump. But when I asked her if she's voting for him in 2020, she says it's too early to talk about that.
So there's support for the wall, but not always for the president using the wall as a non-negotiable demand in the shutdown.
Right. And you hear some Trump supporters say they wish there could be normal negotiations absent the shutdown, especially with Democrats now controlling the House. Listen to this exchange I had with county worker Greg Rouse.
They could have done this when they had the House and Senate.
I agree.
And now he's trying to do it with the Democrats in control of the House.
Yeah, I don't understand what, but I don't think they had a very strong Republican House to start with. I don't think Paul Ryan was very good. I don't know. That is kind of puzzling.
So they're sticking with Trump.
Yeah. But you can hear the frustration there. NPR national political correspondent Don Gagne.
Pleasure.
Now let's hear the effects in Washington, where the traffic has seemed a bit lighter at rush hour lately. Fewer people are going to work. Tourists have fewer destinations since many museums are closed. The lack of people is affecting Washington restaurants and food trucks. Here's Michaela LaFranc of our member station WAMU.
On a regular day at lunchtime, the streets around the National Mall are crammed with tourists and office workers. But these are the days of the shutdown, and things are far from normal.
There's no tourists, nothing.
Mohammed Bada leans out his Mediterranean food truck and surveys the empty streets. He's parked in a prime spot, right near the National Portrait Gallery and a couple big federal office buildings. But business is horrible.
So far, I have not even sold one piece of falafel. Nothing. Not even one piece of French fries.
The portrait gallery's closed, as are all Smithsonian museums here. Normally, Bada sells about 80 lunches a day to tourists and office workers. During the partial shutdown, he's been averaging a fourth of that. He says he can't hold out much longer.
Next week, we're going to stay like this. I'm going to shut down. It's really bad.
Restaurants big and small are feeling the pain. Kathy Hollinger is the president of the Metropolitan Washington Restaurant Association.
They are seeing a decrease in sales ranging from 20% to as high as 60%. And that is a lot.
She says dozens of restaurants have been offering special deals to furloughed workers, free coffee, or 20% off a meal.
They want to help and they want to give back to a constituency that has been loyal but may right now not be in a position to be able to come in and spend money.
The deals help attract business, too. But not all restaurants can afford to offer steep discounts. Kristen Braybrook is the executive pastry chef at a local bakery called Bakers and Baristas. They've been giving away free coffee, but it's not enough to make up for lost business.
It's been rough. I mean, we rely so much on office parties and meetings and all that sort of stuff, and there's just nobody having birthday parties and nobody having meetings because nobody's in the office.
Their sales have been down by more than 30% from last January. At their sister business, a cupcake shop down the street, sales are down 50%. She's had to start making a lot of tough decisions regarding her staff.
It's really depressing. I mean, we're cutting hours left and right. It's difficult to have those conversations, especially with people with kids, and you're just like, I'm really sorry. Like, these are literally all the hours I can give you. Yeah, it's heartbreaking.
Even as they cut shifts, restaurants are being deluged with applications from furloughed employees in need of a paycheck. One furloughed worker has been picking up bartending shifts at a fine dining restaurant across the street from the White House. Others have turned to food delivery as a way to earn cash. Braybrook says she has just one thing to say to the politicians debating the federal budget in Congress, just a mile away.
Stop having standoffs with each other and think about all the little people who are not getting paid.
She says she knows it isn't that easy. She's really just hoping the shutdown ends by Valentine's Day. It's their biggest sales day of the year, and her livelihood depends on it. For NPR News, I'm Michaela LaFrac in Washington.
And later this afternoon on All Things Considered, it has been 3 months since Hurricane Michael flattened Mexico Beach, Florida. And that city is still struggling to just remove all the debris. You can listen to that story by asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your local member station by name.
This is NPR News.
On 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR News station. Coming up on WBUR's Morning Edition, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh on the government shutdown and the priorities of the nation's mayors. Walsh is attending a mayor's meeting in Washington today. Now the forecast. You might want the slicker and the umbrella today. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
We'll see some rain around the area. It could be heavy at times. It's mild, well into the 50s. That gusty wind, maybe some power outages, 1 to 2 inches of rain. Tonight, the rain comes to an end early. We clear out. We go to the 20s. And on Friday, it's sunny, but it's colder in the mid-30s, seasonable for January. Saturday, sunshine, a little colder, temperature in the upper 20s. Sunday, a blend of clouds and sun, low 40s. Monday, chilly but sunny.
In Boston now, 52 degrees.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston Building Resources, a member-owned co-op committed to practical kitchen designs for the way you live and cook. Learn more at bostonbuildingresources.com. Airtable, an all-in-one collaboration platform used by over 80,000 companies, Airtable is designed to help companies manage their work their way. Learn more at airtable.com. And Sophos, for protecting individuals and businesses from cyber threats, powered by artificial intelligence, Sophos deep learning technology is designed to predict and stop ransomware, viruses, and other cyber threats before they strike.
Now, Bostonomics Business, the now bankrupt parent company of Dedham-based Papageno's and D'Angelo's Sandwiches, is moving forward with its sale to a private investment firm. The sale to Windchurch Capital was approved yesterday. It does not include franchise locations. The company abruptly closed dozens of its Papageno's restaurants in November as it filed for bankruptcy. The Burlington-based 3D metal printing firm Desktop Metal says it's raised $160 million as it gets ready to unveil a new system to print on a mass production scale. The largest portion of the new money came from a branch of Koch Industries. Desktop Metal is now valued at around $1.5 billion. This is WBUR at 7:45.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Maplewood Country Day Camp, Southeastern Mass, where children can experience the joys of summer and learn a variety of life skills. MaplewoodYearRound.com. And Xfinity, offering Xfinity Internet that can provide service to over 12 devices at the same time. More at Xfinity.com or 1-800-XFINITY.
This is WBUR. I'm Bob Oakes. On Beacon Hill, legislators are just beginning to pore over Governor Charlie Baker's new state budget. The $42.7 billion spending plan landed in their inboxes yesterday. Among other things, it recommends that funding for K-12 public education be increased by $1 billion in the next 7 years. More from WBUR's Steve Brown.
It's the opening salvo of the state budget debate, the annual three-way tug of war between the governor, the House, and the Senate over how to spend the state's limited resources. In years past, a structural deficit coupled with runaway spending on mass health meant some major priorities just had to take a back seat to more pressing issues. Now, with the deficit and mass health issues somewhat resolved, Governor Charlie Baker is looking to other investment priorities, starting with education.
Today, alongside our budget proposal, we're filing a multi-year school finance reform initiative, which will increase funding for school districts to invest in a quality education for every child, regardless of their zip code, including a significant increase in funding for communities with the highest need.
While the governor continues to tout Massachusetts' public education achievements, he acknowledges the existence of an achievement gap that has left some students in poorer school districts lagging behind those in more well-to-do areas. The governor's budget adopts proposals from a special school funding commission that recommended increased spending on health care, special education, low-income students, and English language learners. The school funding boost is being praised by many, including Marie Frances Rivera of the Mass Budget and Policy Center.
The governor's proposal is an indication that he understands the need for new revenue and supporting all the things that we care about. You know, in order to make the bold moves that we want to in the state, we're going to need to raise significant new revenue on top of what the governor proposed in order to make those investments.
But Eileen McEnany of the Massachusetts Taxpayers Foundation is more cautious.
I think it's important that we do begin to address some of the issues that were highlighted in the Foundation Budget Review Commission. For Mass taxpayers, though, what we will really look at and make sure that any education funding proposal is very clear on the goals that they're trying to achieve.
And that's part of what's in the governor's companion bill. It gives the education commissioner more authority to approve turnaround plans for underperforming schools, as well as withhold funds from lagging districts until they accept suggested remedies. The focus on education funding and reform in the governor's budget overshadowed some other key provisions in the document. He's recommending the state allow sports betting, predicting that will bring in $35 million during the upcoming fiscal year. He wants to modernize sales tax collection by having big vendors pay earlier and more frequently, and he's suggesting expanding the state's cigarette tax to vaping products. Governor Baker is also looking to the manufacturers of opioids to help pay for treating those who suffer from substance misuse. He's proposing a tax on their gross receipts from the sale of opioid products, saying it will bring in an extra $14 million to defray the cost.
The manufacturers have a lot to do with creating the crisis that we all are paying for every day, and creating a mechanism in which they put something in to help pay for the carnage they've created, I think, is important.
With the governor's budget now filed, the next moves are up to the legislature. After a series of hearings in February and March, the House will put out its version of the budget in April, and the Senate will follow suit in May. Both the House and Senate versions will be reconciled into a final budget scheduled sometime in June. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Steve Brown at the State House.
Hundreds of mayors from around the country are meeting right now in Washington, D.C. to discuss initiatives, brainstorm, and network. Among the attendees is Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, who joins us this morning to give us the scoop on what's on his mind and the mayor's minds. Good morning, Mayor Walsh. Thanks for speaking to WBUR's Morning Edition.
Thanks, Bob. Thank you. Good morning.
You know, of course, the talk in Washington and around the country right now is the partial federal government shutdown today in day 34. I imagine it's high on the list of concerns for mayors. What are you all doing about it?
It is. We had a lot of conversations over the last 24 hours about talking to our congressional people, both in the Congress and the Senate, going up to Capitol Hill and forcing them to take action here on opening up the government again. You know, we are a bipartisan group of mayors, Democrats and Republicans. We don't get caught up in the issues of the partisanship. And you know, when you're a mayor, whether you're a Republican or Democrat, if your funds aren't coming down, if your city's not being properly attended to, there are issues. And we're focusing on, first of all, talking about trying to get this government open. Secondly, we're focusing on infrastructure, a major push for housing across America, and a major push for the environment across America. And really, because all of those issues affect every single mayor, whether you're in a rural or suburban area, whatever coast you're on. Those are all common themes that we work on here.
Let me talk about housing and ask about a survey out this week from Boston University, which showed housing costs as one of the top concerns of big city mayors nationwide, regardless of their party. What are you and the mayor saying about that issue, and are the ways it can be tackled by the mayors cooperating?
That seems to be a common theme all across this country, the rising cost of housing in every single city and town. And one of the things that we're doing a very aggressive plan in Boston, and a lot of mayors are looking to us on what we've done already in the last 5 years and building the amount of housing that we're doing and our housing goals of 69,000 units by the year 2030. But in saying that, we're also concerned that there's no federal plan.
You think you could squeeze money out of this Congress and this president for new housing?
I think the issue is we will get a better chance of getting a good plan out of the Congress. I'm not sure how good the plan will be out of the Senate. I mean, that's why I'm going to talk to Senator Markey today. Senator Markey is very focused on an infrastructure bill. We talked about it last weekend in Boston. I think his concerns are what do the Republicans in the Senate tack onto the bill? How do they try and bog the bill down? And I think that the one thing that's very important for the mayors to play here is that the mayors that are here in this conference live in those districts that these senators are around the country. So we have to push up. We have to put the pressure where it belongs. And it's not about partisan politics. It has to be about literally, we're talking about an infrastructure bill, moving our country forward.
If you could add one item to an infrastructure bill that would be most important to the city of Boston, what would it be? What project would you tackle?
I think one of the things that I'd like to see, even though it's not under the purview of the city of Boston, I think public transportation is probably one of the biggest inputs that I'd like to see some major investments in.
Let me, if I might, as we begin to close, circle back to the federal government shutdown. There's some suggestion the shutdown is proving to be a drag on the U.S. economy. Have you seen any signs of that here? And what are your concerns about that?
Well, not yet, but it's affecting our stock market, this volatility in the stock market. We have some concerns in the lending areas. We have 46,000 federal employees. We have 7,500 that are impacted statewide. We have 1,300 roughly in the Suffolk County area. So 46,000 people being affected by the government indirectly or directly is going to be a problem. If this drags on as we continue to move forward here, it will affect our economy.
So what steps can Boston take to prepare in case this shutdown does drag on for weeks longer or maybe even months longer?
Well, I think first and foremost, we have to figure out, I know that there's some ideas about how do we help federal employees in Massachusetts, is there an opportunity for us to look at extending unemployment benefits to them? Is there something that, we can do, whether it's cities and towns or the legislature can do? We're working with some nonprofit groups now and on looking at doing some food drives and things like that to be able to allow people the opportunity to be able to get food or access food, something that's really important.
Boston Mayor Marty Walsh speaking to us from the U.S. Conference of Mayors in Washington. Thanks a lot for dropping in to WBUR's Morning Edition.
Thanks, Bob.
Whether you get your news from the radio, your laptop, or phone, you depend on WBUR and NPR for unbiased news every day. So what's on the horizon? How will you listen in the future? With the first ever campaign for WBUR, we're bringing our content to you in new ways, on air, online, on demand, and on stage at City Space. Together, we're building the future of public radio. Find out more at wbur.org/future.
Still to come this hour on WBUR's Morning Edition, the most anticipated films at the Sundance Film Festival, which opens today in Park City, Utah. At 10 this morning, it's On Point with Meghna Charkhabarti. In the first hour today, a look at the NFL just ahead of the Super Bowl with the New England Patriots and the LA Rams, and a look at the huge flap over a blown call on the field last weekend that probably kept the New Orleans Saints out of the game. In the second On Point hour at 11, freedom and equality. One philosopher's belief that we think of them all wrong. That's On Point today on WBUR. Forecast rainy and windy but mild today. It'll be in the 50s. Heavy rain coming this afternoon. It blows out and clears out and goes to the 20s tonight. Sunny skies tomorrow in the mid-30s. The weekend, sunny Saturday in the 20s. Partly sunny in the 40s on Sunday. In Boston now, 52 degrees. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Worcester Art Museum, featuring Flora in Winter, a four-day floral extravaganza with art-inspired arrangements throughout the museum now through January 27th, and the exhibition Monet's Waterloo Bridge, Vision and Process, opening on January 25th. More at worcesterart.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. It is a busy week for the movie industry. The Oscar nominations are out, and one of the industry's biggest film festivals kicks off today. Actors, directors, executives, and of course critics are on their way to the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. NPR film critic Kenneth Turan is among them, but before heading to the mountains, he talked with David Green.
Hi there, Ken.
Hey, David, how you doing?
I'm good. Sad to be missing you. I was there with you last year. I'm not going this time, so you'll have to send the stories.
They're
going to
miss you. They're asking about you
sure
already.
Sure they
David.
Are, I'm sure. So I want to start with Dr. Ruth, the sex therapist. Is she has a movie here?
Dr. Ruth, well, she didn't make a movie. It's a documentary about her.
Huh.
But she is a trip, as they used to say. You know, she's 90 years old. She's still working. She's still great and funny and lively. But this tells her story. You know, she was a Holocaust refugee. She grew up in another country. Her parents died. She ended up in Israel. She was a sniper for the Haganah.
She was a sniper?
Yes, I know.
Wow.
And she's 4'7". Yeah. I don't know if that's good or bad for a sniper.
Me neither.
Just how she got started, how the program caught on, how her personality just has kind of lit people up from the start to today. It's really a treat to be in her presence.
It's a life that it sounds like that's a lot to take on for one movie. I mean, there have been a bunch of different lives during her 90 years.
They really have. That's why it's so interesting. I mean, again, this is one of those things where this is a person you think you know. Everyone, you say Dr. Ruth and everyone has a picture,
yeah.
And that picture is true, but there's a lot more to it that nobody really has known until now.
And Kenny, what's the name of the Dr. Ruth film?
It's called Ask Dr. Ruth.
Ask Dr. Ruth. Seems appropriate. Okay, someone else I think many people think they know is Mindy Kaling. But it sounds like she's going to be in a film about having a late night talk show. That sounds fun.
It's a film about a late night talk show. It's called Late Night.
Okay.
And it's a script that she wrote and she stars in. And she co-stars with Emma Thompson. And Emma Thompson plays the woman who's been the host of this late night talk show for 28 years. And the lines that Mindy Kaling has written for Emma Thompson's character are hysterical. Mindy Kaling plays a diversity hire intern who comes into an all-male comedy room and has to cope with that and cope with Emma Thompson's show, which is having some difficulties, needs to kind of find a new direction. So it's a very smart film. It's a funny film. It's an unexpected film. I think it's going to be a real crowd pleaser, a real audience film.
Might learn a lot about what late night television is like.
It's not a pretty picture.
Huh. Oh, interesting. Well, what a rise it's been for Mindy Kaling, too. I mean, from The Office to she had her own show for a while. Now she's writing a film that you say is going to be a crowd pleaser and probably, I imagine, one that distributors are going to be trying to grab at Sundance.
Yeah, no, I think definitely the distributors are going to be lined up. It's got a key slot on Friday night, and everyone's going to be waiting for this, and, you know, bids will be made.
So what else are you excited to go see?
You know, there's something called Maiden that I really enjoyed. It's a documentary that is already played at Toronto, but sometimes Sundance brings in films that it really likes, even if they've debuted somewhere else.
Oh, interesting.
And Maiden is about the first all-female crew on an around-the-world yacht race. And it's such a heartening story. You know, the women now, it's like 30 years after the fact, they talk about the experience. The men who didn't believe that this was possible for an all-women crew, they talk about kind of how foolish they were. It's just a wonderful story. It was, you know, it's one of these against all odds documentaries where people fight tremendous obstacles. I just felt so good watching this film. It was just wonderful.
The fact that you're excited to see something again. Yeah.
I look forward to the next time I see it.
What's the weather supposed to be like? Snow?
I'm afraid to look, David.
Okay, don't look. Just report back. That is Kenneth Turan. Ken, thanks a lot, as always.
Oh, thank you, David.
He reviews movies for the Los Angeles Times and for us here at Morning Edition.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the BSO. Juan Omena leads Haydn, Mendelssohn, and Janacek with violinist Julian Racklin January 31st to February 5th at Symphony Hall. BSO.org.
From Boston University, you're listening to 90.9 WBUR-FM Boston, home of Boston's largest radio newsroom, 92.7 WBUA Tisbury, 89.1 WBUH Brewster, and streaming at WBUR.org. WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. The State of the Union address is now officially canceled. President Trump says he won't do it while the government shutdown continues. Today is Thursday, January 24th. This is Morning Edition. Good morning, I'm Bob Oakes. Coming up, Trump's decision on the speech. It came after House Speaker Pelosi made official her refusal to use the House chamber for the speech. Also, both expected to fail. Two Senate votes today on ending the shutdown. Here's Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell.
Enough political spite. Enough. Enough showboating.
And Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer.
I know that President Trump has some power in these Republican primaries, but sometimes you got to rise to the occasion.
And this hour, the opposition already forming to Governor Baker's new plan to increase taxes on real estate sales. Rainy day ahead, some heavy rain, but in the 50s today. It's 8:01. Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Kuhlman. President Trump has abruptly reversed course, saying he will now wait until after the partial federal government shutdown ends to deliver his State of the Union address. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, the announcement came via late-night tweets.
In tweets sent just after 11 p.m., President Trump said Speaker Pelosi's decision not to allow the State of the Union to be delivered in the House chamber until after the shutdown ends is her prerogative. He added that he isn't looking for an alternative venue to deliver the address because, quote, there is no venue that can compete with the history, tradition, and importance of the House chamber. I look forward to giving a great State of the Union address in the near future. Pelosi responded, saying she hoped that phrase near future meant Trump would accept the Democratic bill being voted on in the Senate to end the shutdown. That seems unlikely. Just Wednesday, President Trump had attempted to call Pelosi's bluff, saying he intended to deliver the address as planned January 29th, only to accept her position several hours later. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
In addition to the bill backed by Democrats, the Senate will take up a competing Republican proposal today that incorporates President Trump's demand for a border wall. It would also drastically change some U.S. asylum laws. Both Senate bills are expected to fail. Online news and entertainment site BuzzFeed says it's laying off 15% of its workforce. NPR's Elizabeth Blair says the job cuts were announced by BuzzFeed founder Jonah Peretti.
Peretti's memo begins, "I'm writing with sad news." He goes on to say that after examining trends and the evolving economics of digital platforms, executives plan to consolidate teams and focus in on the content that's working. Since BuzzFeed was founded in 2006, the competition for clicks and digital ad revenue has increased significantly, with both small companies and behemoths like Facebook Facebook. Peretti says details on the cuts will be announced by Monday at the latest. BuzzFeed News recently published an explosive story alleging that President Trump urged his ex-lawyer Michael Cohen to lie to Congress. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Following that BuzzFeed report alleging Trump told Cohen to lie to Congress, the Office of Special Counsel Robert Mueller issued a statement disputing elements of the article. Police in South Central Florida say they've arrested a suspect in connection with the shooting deaths of five people on Wednesday in a bank. The police chief of Sebring, Florida, Carl Hoagland, says the victims were discovered after a SWAT team entered the bank and captured the suspect.
Today's been a tragic day in our community. We've suffered a significant loss at the hands of a senseless criminal doing a senseless crime.
The suspect is 21-year-old Zephyr Zaver, who is from Sebring. Until last year, he was a trainee prison guard. It's not clear if the shootings were related to a bank robbery. This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good morning. I'm Bob Oakes in Boston. The National Weather Service has put nearly all the state under a flash flood watch for today. It's because up to 2 inches of rain could fall by late this afternoon. Here's State Emergency Management Agency spokesman Chris Bessie.
Normally, that amount of rainfall doesn't amount to much significance, but here where we've got a lot of snow and ice on the ground, there's a chance it could lead to some localized flooding, street flooding, maybe some basement flooding.
We'll have the forecast in a few minutes. On Beacon Hill, Governor Baker is out with his new $42.7 billion state budget proposal. WBUR's Steve Brown says it includes a plan to help seniors with rising medical costs.
There's this federal Medicare savings program, which the states administer. Now, if the state just pays an extra $10 million into that program, low-income seniors will get about $100 million back in assistance from the feds to help them pay for Medicare A and B premiums and other out-of-pocket expenses.
The governor is not proposing any new broad-based taxes, but is calling for a new tax on pharmaceutical companies that sell opioids. He also wants to increase a tax buyers pay in real estate sales to pay for climate change initiatives. And there's funding for union contracts in the UMass system, a plan welcomed by UMass President Marty Meehan.
We're very happy with the proposal from the governor. Among the many things that we're most appreciative is the fact that the governor's budget fully funds collective bargaining.
In the past, the legislature is not always fully funded cost of living hikes, leaving the universities to pay for them by raising tuition and fees on students. The State Gaming Commission meets this morning to discuss restarting the bidding process for a gaming license in southeastern Mass. The commission denied a bid 3 years ago for a casino on the Brockton Fairgrounds. Backers of that plan have been asking commissioners to reopen the bid for the license. The Handel and Haydn Society's artistic director says he's stepping down. More from WBUR's Cynthia Lopez.
Harry Christophers will leave the Handel and Haydn Society in 2021. At that point, he'll have led the Baroque and Classical organization for 12 years. Christophers will then dedicate his time to his vocal ensemble and his orchestra in England. He says he is at a good place in his tenure to step down, but he'll miss Boston.
The response of the audience in concerts is just electrifying. It's actually quite unique, I have to say. Boston is a very special place.
The Handel and Haydn Society says it's conducting an international search for Christopher's successor. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Cynthia Lopez.
It's 8:07.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Mass General Cancer Center at Newton Wellesley, a fully integrated cancer center in Newton that gives patients seamless access to the entire team of Mass General Cancer experts, which means they're more than just a world-class cancer center. They're neighbors. To learn more, visit massgeneral.org/cancercenter@NWH. And Tire Rack, offering a tire decision guide to help customers find tires that fit their car and driving conditions, with a network of more than 7,000 independent installers. TireRack.com, helping drivers find, deliver, install.
Sports make it 5 wins in a row for the Celtics with last night's 123-103 win over the Cleveland Cavaliers at the Garden. Celts play again Saturday when they host the Golden State Warriors. Traffic 495 in Marlboro. The exits to Route 20 eastbound remain closed because of a nearby fire. 93 north slow from the Braintree split to Storrow Drive. The Mass Pike eastbound is 25 minutes from 128 to the Prue Tunnel. Forecast: clouds. It'll feel like spring today. Temperatures in the 50s, and we'll have rain. Some heavy rain this afternoon. Tonight, the rain stops and it clears. Falls to the 20s tonight. Sunny tomorrow in the 30s. Sunny on Saturday in the 20s. Then Sunday, it'll be in the 40s and partly sunny. In Boston now, 53 degrees. 53 in Watertown, 52 in Peabody, and 52 in Attleboro at 8:08.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Venezuela has two men claiming to be president right now. Opposition leader Juan Guaido and sitting leader Nicolas Maduro are locked in a battle for power. Speaking to cheering crowds yesterday, Guaido declared himself the country's interim president.
Del Ejecutivo Nacional. Como el presidente encargado de Venezuela.
The Trump administration quickly gave him its support, but Maduro has not agreed to cede power. In fact, in response, he announced a break in diplomatic relations with Washington, D.C., and ordered U.S. personnel out of the country. NPR's Philip Reeves is in Caracas and joins us now. Phil, I guess just the big question, who is in charge this morning?
Oh, I think there's no doubt that in truth, Maduro remains in office and he is the de facto president of the country right now. He controls all the instruments of power. He controls the Supreme Court, the intelligence agencies and the military. Which way the military goes in this will be critical in determining the outcome of it. So far, there's no really concrete evidence that's emerged, although there are a lot of rumors that suggest the military is ready to abandon Maduro. But that could be a really key factor. So we have one man, Juan Guaido, who's the head of the National Assembly. He's declared himself interim president. He says he's a transitional leader until free and fair elections are held. The U.S. supports him. Many others do, too. The U.S. has helped orchestrate this. But Maduro, in fact, remains in office.
I mean, you say the U.S. has helped orchestrate this. It is interesting. There are a lot of international implications to what's happening in Venezuela right now.
Yeah. I mean, we are witnessing a major coordinated drive to push Maduro out of office, to end the economic and humanitarian crisis that's been going on here for a long time, that's been getting worse, and that's been causing severe problems in the neighborhood because of mass migration. The U.S. is playing a central role in that. Maduro's accusing it of orchestrating a coup and is drawing comparisons with the Cold War years when the U.S. was, U.S. interventions in Latin America, including in organizing behind-the-scenes coups. He's drawing that comparison. And let's not forget that Maduro has some big friends on the international stage. His government's been propped up for years by China and Russia, and more recently Turkey. And Turkey's been expressing their support for him. They say that by recognizing someone else as president, the U.S. and others could cause chaos here.
In the meantime, the U.S. diplomats are caught in the middle of this. I mean, Venezuelans in general are the ones who are really bearing the brunt. But are the U.S. diplomats going to leave now that Maduro has told them they have to?
Well, this has become a really critical issue. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says that Maduro doesn't have the legal authority to break diplomatic relations with the U.S. because, you know, the U.S. doesn't recognize him as president. It therefore follows that the U.S. thinks Maduro doesn't have the legal authority to throw out its diplomats. But what happens if they don't leave? Maduro controls the streets here right now. He controls the security forces. Last night on TV, a senior member of the Socialist Party was talking, which is the ruling party allied to Maduro's regime, which was talking about cutting off water and electricity to the U.S. embassy if the diplomats don't leave after 72 hours as instructed. Now, that may well just be rhetoric to please the crowd, but we really don't know how this is going to play out.
What's Guaido's next step? I mean, it's one thing for him to stand among throngs of cheering supporters and say, I am the interim president. But what's he going to do to bring about a new vote if he even has the ability to do that?
Well, it's difficult to know because the National Assembly has been totally sidelined by Maduro for a long time now. And the Supreme Court here, which he controls, has just reinforced that by declaring the National Assembly's decisions null and void. So, he has declared himself to be interim president, but where he's going to take that is difficult to know. Having said that, having all that international support, especially from the U.S., the biggest player on the block, mm-hmm. is extremely important. It's a source of influence for him, and it's also important because it's backed up by U.S. threats of more sanctions.
Just briefly, Phil, what are you hearing from people on the streets? I mean, this is political chaos there. What are the effects of people's day-to-day lives?
Well, you know, the protests against Maduro yesterday were huge. Hundreds of thousands of people were on the street. They were very happy when Guaido declared himself interim president, although they weren't ecstatic. You know, they've had high hopes before, only to see them dashed. And they're exhausted. On the other hand, Maduro does have some supporters. His Socialist Party had big rallies yesterday, and they all see this as another chapter in the U.S. war against Venezuela, as they call it, aimed at taking control of their country.
NPR's Philip Reeves reporting from Caracas. Thanks so much, Phil.
You're welcome.
Now let's return to the United States to talk of religious voters. When we talk about voters who are people of faith, religious conservatives get most of the attention. But with liberals increasingly energized, some faith leaders want to rally religious voters for progressive causes. NPR's Tom Gelton reports on the prospects for reviving the religious left.
There's been no hotter political issue in recent months than what to do about all the migrants, including families, showing up at the U.S. border. Among those pushing for a more open policy is a group called Faith in Public Life. It's led by an ordained Presbyterian minister, Jennifer Butler, who shows up at rallies wearing her clerical collar.
So today we say what Moses said to Pharaoh. Let my people go. Let the children go. Say it with me.
Rallies like this one are not uncommon, but Reverend Butler says her movement is grounded in religion.
There are over 100 verses of scripture that say we're to welcome immigrants and welcome strangers. And so I think we're driven by our moral values and not by politics.
Besides supporting migrants, Butler's movement advocates for LGBT rights, universal health care, and racial justice. She founded the organization 13 years ago with a precedent in mind. It was religious leaders who drove the abolitionist movement in the 19th century and the civil rights movement in the 20th.
I think religion helps people understand who they should be.
Butler's group and others of like mind and mission represent a renewed faith-based movement on the left. The obvious comparison is to the religious right. The Reverend Jerry Falwell founded the Moral Majority in the late 70s to oppose abortion and promote private Christian schools during a time of cultural change.
What motivated the religious right to begin organizing is a feeling of loss.
Henry Olson is the author of The Four Faces of the Republican Party.
They felt their deepest values from their religion were being taken away from them.
Now, left-leaning believers feel it's their religious values that are under threat, with respect, for example, to social and economic justice.
Jesus talked about reaching out to the poor, reaching out to the marginalized, reaching out to the oppressed.
Tara Harris is a lay leader at Myers Park Baptist Church in Charlotte, North Carolina, and newly active in support of immigrant rights.
The way that I personally interpret my own Christian faith and my own Christian walk, it's an active challenge. How can I make a difference in the lives of others? So I would say there's a direct tie and a direct linkage there for me.
She was speaking there over Skype. The religious left is not yet a match for the more familiar religious right. For one thing, it draws on a smaller base. Surveys show liberals, by various measures, are simply less religious than conservatives. In fact, the agenda of the religious left doesn't seem all that different from what secular groups on the left push for. The religious right, on the other hand, is almost exclusively an evangelical movement, with priorities that secular conservatives don't push quite so much.
They are more interested in preserving the Constitution than the Bible.
Henry Olson is now with the Ethics and Public Policy Center, a center-right think tank.
The secular right may agree on some issues, but they are primarily motivated by a concern about what they would argue is the growing power of government.
The religious left does have some advantages, Reverend Butler argues. She says her Faith in Public Life movement is strengthened by its interfaith character.
We're working with Muslims and Jews and Sikhs and every sort of faith group. We all have the same sort of core values in mind, which is that everybody is created in the image of God and we need to love our neighbor as we love ourselves.
An approach that unites religious traditions makes sense given that the nation is becoming increasingly diverse. Another advantage, Butler thinks the religious left, compared to the secular left, has a deeper commitment to bridge building.
A lot of folks on the secular left are a bit reticent to form common cause with people who see things differently on an issue.
Consider the abortion issue, for example.
We've been able to form alliances with people who are pro-life and pro-choice because all of us agree that there's a common ground of wanting to reduce the numbers of abortions in the country.
One more thought. A politics inspired by moral values is especially passionate. A religious left can bring new energy to a movement with the reputation of being too cerebral.
Jesus, a brown-skinned Palestinian Jew, called us to preach good news to the poor, the broken.
The most rousing speech at the last Democratic convention was delivered by a pastor, the Reverend William Barber of North Carolina. Barber, who combines theology with activism, is now Butler's partner in her religious left coalition. While their movement doesn't yet have the political clout of the religious right, it is growing. Faith in Public Life says it has so far mobilized more than 40,000 local clergy and faith leaders around the country. Tom Gelton, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Coming soon to Commonwealth Avenue outside Kenmore Square, City Space. Learn more about WBUR's new home for public conversation at wbur.org/cityspace.
Just ahead on WBUR's Morning Edition, we examine two parts of Governor Baker's new state budget plan, including his proposal to tax drug makers and his plan to hike a tax that real estate buyers pay in the home sale process to pay for climate change projects. Opponents say it'll hurt the housing market. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Arts Emerson, presenting The End of TV. Experience the power of unlikely friendship amid the static now through January 27th at the Emerson Paramount Center. Tickets at artsemerson.org. And Fidelity Investments, reminding you it's never too early to start saving for your child's future. Learn more about a tax-advantaged 529 college savings account and how you can use the money to pay for qualified expenses at fidelity.com/ufund. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. Member NYSE SIPC.
Now the forecast. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
Temperatures go well into the 50s today. We will see quite a bit of melting. Those gusty winds will also be a problem with 1 to 2 inches of rain. There could be some scattered power outages. The rain heavy at times. It does come to an end during the evening commute. We'll look for clearing skies later tonight. We're down in the 20s. Friday, sunshine, temperatures in the mid to upper 30s. Saturday, it's colder. We're only 25 to 30 with a light wind. And Sunday, back to the 40-degree range with sunshine and clouds. Monday is sunny in the mid-30s.
In Boston now, 53 degrees. It's 8:21.
If you had to work for more than a month without pay, would you still be able to make ends meet?
My little boy's birthday is Friday. Me and my wife talked about last night, like, what are we going to buy him? You know what I mean?
I'm Ari Shapiro, reporting from Louisiana on the government shutdown's impact on one small town. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered, today from 4 to 6:30 on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Constant Contact, whose marketing advisors work directly with small businesses for monthly marketing guidance, personalized support, and email campaign optimization. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. Tire Rack. With more than 500 tire models from 22 manufacturers and an online tool for finding tires based on vehicle, needs, budget, and brand. TireRack.com, helping drivers find, deliver, install. And Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language, like Spanish, French, or German. Babbel's 10- to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at babbel.com.
This is WBUR. Good morning. I'm Bob Oakes. This morning, we're going to dig into Governor Baker's new $42.7 billion state budget plan. In a moment, we'll look at how the governor wants to use a real estate tax to fight climate change. But first, drug prices. The state spent nearly $2 billion last year on drugs prescribed to patients covered by MassHealth. It's double what the state paid just 6 years ago. As WBUR's Martha Biebinger reports, the governor's budget includes a plan to curb that trend and save $80 million.
In short, Governor Baker wants the authority to negotiate lower drug prices. If that doesn't work, the state could set a price. If drug makers refuse, a state commission could hold hearings, and state prosecutors could claim a violation of consumer protection laws. The plan may sound sweeping, but Baker describes a narrow target.
It affects a very small number of drugs. They happen to be a very small number of drugs that have very, very, very big prices on them.
Baker mentions about 20 relatively new drugs, two that cure hepatitis C retail for $84,000 and $94,000 each. Federal law requires that pharmaceutical companies give Medicaid a 23% rebate, but Baker says that's not enough.
There really isn't a process for determining what an appropriate price is for a lot of those new drugs, which is what these 20 drugs fall into. Yet there is a process for determining the price of almost everything else that Medicaid pays for.
MassBio, with more than 1,000 life science members in the state, issued a statement challenging Baker's proposal just a few minutes after the governor finished speaking. No one was available for an interview, but Vice President Zach Stanley reads a portion of that statement here.
Governor Baker's proposal to force certain drug manufacturers to pay supplemental rebates on incredibly effective drugs that MassHealth deems too expensive sends a message across the life sciences industry that government is going to punish success and that only it can be the final arbiter of drug pricing.
Baker was asked if he worries that challenging drug prices will lead to job cuts. He defended the state's record of support for the industry.
Massachusetts, for many years, has made a big investment in the life sciences. It's really important. The discovery really matters.
Consumer advocates agree, but say some of those important discoveries are just not affordable for patients, their employers, and state government. Amy Rosenthal with Healthcare for All says Massachusetts has a long-standing tradition in healthcare of shared responsibility.
Consumers have stepped up, businesses have stepped up, hospitals and insurers. It's time that pharma does their fair share, and we think that this is the year to do that.
New York passed a law that's similar to Baker's proposal. It's early to say if such state laws will reduce drug prices.
It certainly tilts the playing field more in favor of the state than exists right now.
Tom Barker was general counsel for Health and Human Services under President George W. Bush. Baker's plan would not need federal approval, but Barker says the governor may face other obstacles.
There certainly are political risks if the manufacturer just decides they're not going to sell their drug in Massachusetts.
That risk is a ways off. First, Baker must persuade the House and Senate that his drug price negotiation plan is wise. A spokeswoman for Senate President Karen Spilka says the Senate will likely file something similar to help move this issue forward. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Martha Biebinger.
Now the governor's plan to fight climate change. He wants to raise $1 billion for that fight through increased excise taxes on property sales. But as WBUR's Simone Rios reports, it's facing resistance from people in the real estate industry.
Whenever you sell property in Massachusetts, the state makes you pay an excise tax. On a $500,000 home, that comes out to just under $2,300. But now Governor Baker wants to increase that tax to raise another $137 million each year for the purpose of strengthening the state's defenses against climate change. Here's Baker after announcing the measure last week.
It's pretty clear that climate change is starting to have a very significant impact on our communities, on their infrastructure, and this is a way for us to protect people's property and to protect community property.
Local realtors disagree with that approach. They say added taxes means added financial burdens. Ryan Castle is CEO of the Cape Cod and Islands Association of Realtors.
Anytime you add a tax, it's going to make things more expensive. And housing in Massachusetts doesn't need to get artificially more expensive at this time. What you also find is for the Cape, it's going to really impact seniors.
The bill to raise money to address climate change follows a report released this week, which estimates coastal property owners in Massachusetts have lost roughly $270 million in appreciation over the last 12 years. That's due to flooding issues. Matthew Eby of First Street Foundation, which put out the report, feels torn. On the one hand, higher taxes could protect property values. On the other, taxes can make an already high-priced real estate market even less affordable.
That's why I'm calling it Catch-22, because it's really limited funds, where's the biggest impact, and then how do you make those decisions, knowing one is a future-facing problem and is going to get you. It's just a matter of when.
Baker's proposal is tied to the state's Municipal Vulnerability Preparedness Initiative, for which dozens of communities are assessing infrastructure needs facing the uncertain world of climate change. New Bedford Mayor John Mitchell says higher taxes to fix and build seawalls, for example, would be worth it.
We're more prone to flooding than we used to be. Our beaches have eroded and our seawalls need to be shored up. That costs real dollars. And look, it's incumbent upon us, to do these things so that future generations can be, better protected against rising sea levels.
And Mitchell already has a project in mind, a seawall on New Bedford's southern peninsula, one that serves as a barrier between a sewer main and a rising ocean. The state might not pay for the whole thing, Mitchell says, but some new resiliency funds could help. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Simon Rios.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the BSO. Juan Omena leads Haydn, Mendelssohn, and Janacek with violinist Julian Racklin January 31st to February 5th at Symphony Hall, bso.org. The Greater Boston Leadership Program at MIT Sloan, an executive certificate course in leadership for professionals, Mondays this spring, mit.edu/boston. And Ansel Adams in Our Time at the Museum of Fine Arts. Iconic American landscape photographs inspire a new generation of photographers, now through February 24th.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The partial government shutdown is in its 34th day. The Senate is voting on two proposals today to end the impasse. One includes the money President Trump wants for a border wall. The other reopens the government fully through February 8th. Neither is expected to pass. Democratic leaders in Congress want the president to end the partial shutdown before negotiating the details of border security. White House spokeswoman Mercedes Schlapp is critical of that approach.
They don't even want to have a discussion with the president. The president has asked time and time again to come to a compromise, and they refuse to do so.
Schlapp was speaking to NPR's Morning Edition. The president says he'll wait to deliver his State of the Union address until the partial shutdown is over. TSA screeners at the nation's airports are among those in the federal workforce going without pay during the partial shutdown. Pat St. Clair with member station WABE reports on efforts by the city of Atlanta to help TSA employees ahead of Super Bowl 53.
Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms wants to help ease the financial burden. The city is working to set up short-term, low-interest loans for workers who are still required to report to work. The city expects 100,000 people to pass through its airport for the Super Bowl.
The New England Patriots will be playing the Los Angeles Rams in the Super Bowl a week from Sunday. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good morning. I'm Bob Oaks in Boston. There's mixed reaction to Governor Baker's bill to crack down on drug driving now that marijuana is legal here. The bill would allow the suspension of a driver's license if the driver is arrested and refuses a chemical test for impairment. Chelsea Police Chief Brian Keyes supports it, saying it gives police more tools to help with prosecutions.
Right now, police officers, to formulate probable cause at a roadside stop that somebody perhaps is impaired by marijuana is not all that difficult. But beyond the testimony in court of a drug recognition expert, the case is not going to go any further.
On the other side, the American Civil Liberties Union says there's no test that determines if someone is operating under the influence of marijuana the same way a breathalyzer tests for alcohol impairment. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission says the owners of the Pilgrim Nuclear Plant in Plymouth have finished addressing more than 150 issues identified in an action plan. So the commission tells the Cape Cod Times it's now reassessing its level of inspection for the plant. Pilgrim is scheduled to shut down later this year. The mayor of Methuen, James Jajuga, is moving ahead to send layoff notices to the city's police department. He says 50 of Methuen's 71 patrolmen could be laid off because the city council delayed a vote on restoring funding to the police budget. Paul Fahey, the mayor's chief of staff, says the police contract protects higher-ranking officers from layoffs.
The only solution at this point, we believe, unfortunately, is to lay off patrolmen, which is going to have a very negative impact on public safety in the city. But we cannot deficit spend the police department budget.
Methuen city councilors could still vote to restore the funding. It was a 20-point win last night for the Celtics over the Cleveland Cavaliers, 123-103 at the Garden. Celts' next game is Saturday when they host the Golden State Warriors. Traffic, 24 South in Bridgewater, there's a crash on the ramp to 495 North. Masspike westbound in Newton, there's a crash blocking the left lane after Route 16. And 93 South is now 35 minutes from the Fellsway to the Leverett Connector. Forecast, rainy day, some heavy rain this afternoon. 1 to 2 inches of rain is possible today. Highs today in the mid-50s. Clearing tonight, lows in the 20s. Sunny tomorrow, it'll be in the mid-30s. Sunny Saturday and only in the 20s. Partly sunny on Sunday. It'll be in the 40s on Sunday. In Boston now, 53 degrees, 49 in Worcester, 52 degrees in Lowell, and 54 degrees in Plymouth at 8:35.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by NBC 10 Boston with a new weather notification system for when impactful conditions are in the forecast. First alert weather warnings on NBC 10 Boston. Indeed, used by over 3 million businesses for hiring, where employers can post jobs and use screener questions to build their short list of preferred candidates. Learn more at Indeed.com/hire. And Capterra, for helping people find the right software for their business. From project management to yoga studio software, users can read reviews and compare solutions across hundreds of software categories. More at Capterra.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. In his final State of the Union speech in 2016, President Obama declared the state of our union is strong. In his State of the Union speech in 2018, President Trump declared the state of our union is strong. It's a common sentiment. President Bush said it. President Clinton said it. Today, we can say the state of the union is delayed. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi made it definite yesterday the president may not use the House chamber until a partial government shutdown is over. The president replied by Twitter last night that that is her prerogative and he will wait. NPR political editor Domenico Montanaro never waits. He's here once again this morning. Domenico, good morning.
Hey there, Stephen. I'll wait as long as you need.
Okay. Why did the president not seek some other place?
Well, he decided to relent and back down, which is not usual for his for what he's done over his presidency. But he decided that he was not going to seek a different venue. He tweeted that there's no venue that can compete with the history, tradition, and importance of the House chamber. He said he looks forward to giving it in the near future after the shutdown is over. And, you know, it's probably no coincidence that there were three polls out yesterday continuing to show the president's numbers getting worse and worse during this shutdown. People are blaming him for it. They're saying the shutdown is more of a problem than the border. Hmm. And his approval rating in an AP poll, for example, went to 34%, the lowest of his presidency in that poll. And among independents, almost 7 in 10 disapprove of the job he's doing.
You know, I was looking at the 538 polling average. You'd take an average of polls, since any one poll might be a little off. His approval rating was 10 points underwater in December, like 41% approved, around 51% disapproved, which is really bad. And now it is far worse, something like 55-39, 55% disapproval and only 39% approval. That is appalling for a president.
Yeah, it's really expanded since the government shutdown began December 21st. And, you know, it's hard to ignore a confluence of polls. You know, you can cherry pick one thing, but when you see that trend, which is really the way to to consume them, even the president has to look at that and think something has to change here. And, you know, a Fox News poll was out yesterday. They conduct very good polls, and it showed, you know, three quarters of the country think that the shutdown is a big problem compared to fewer than that, maybe about 6 in 10 who thought the border was.
And, of course, that's this poll that we would presume the president has seen since he spends a lot of time watching Fox News and often tweeting about it, although he hasn't tweeted that poll so far as we know.
Probably not going to tweet that not favorable to
him. Have Democrats offered the president any way to get out of this?
Well, Democrats have not offered anything yet to the president except to say that open the government back up and then we can negotiate, which is what Democrats are saying. You know, that's one of the bills that's going to be voted on today and expected to fail. Of course, the president's proposal in the Senate is also going to be voted on, where he wants $5.7 billion for a wall and offering temporary protections for immigrants in the country. But Democrats are likely to offer a counterproposal, according to NPR's Susan Davis, that does spend significantly on border security, just not going to offer anything for that wall.
Would it be $5.7 billion, which is the exact amount the president is demanding, just not for a wall, for other kinds of security?
Well, you know, Democrats have shown a penchant to actually spend potentially more money than that in past years when it comes to other things. When you think about, drones or technology, really the wall has become symbolic for both Democrats and Republicans, at least for this president, to say that this is his physical view of saying that he's tough on the border, and Democrats saying that this is also a physical view of saying that you're trying to keep people out. So, because Democrats in the past, of course, have been in favor of securing various parts of the border and fencing.
Domenico, thanks for the update. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That's NPR political editor Domenico Montanaro.
Spain received the highest number of migrants on their shores last year, topping both Italy and Greece. Spain saw a sharp increase of arrivals last summer, which overwhelmed refugee centers in the south. And this year, Spanish officials expect the number to keep rising. Lucia Benavides reports.
Mamaru Laminsar is ironing shirts for a clothing store in downtown Barcelona. The store is run by an association of undocumented migrants. Sar, who's from Senegal, is one of the union's founding members. He says they opened the shop in 2017 to help migrants find steady work. Since he arrived in Spain in 2006, Sar says, he's had to take care of himself. There's been virtually no official support, just some help from local activists and the migrant community. This past year, he says he's seen the numbers increase as authorities bus migrants into Barcelona from overcrowded reception centers in the south. They drop you off at a bus station, Sara says, and you don't know anyone. The only solution, he adds, is to sleep on the street until someone helps you out. Maria Dantas is one of those people. She works with a network of activists across Spain to coordinate help for migrants with nowhere to go.
El verano fue realmente un pico.
This summer, we saw a peak in arrivals. Our goal was to not let these people stay in the streets.
Around 58,000 migrants arrived in Spain in 2018, more than double the number in the previous year. Dantas says authorities were totally unprepared.
There was a lack of foresight and provisions in place for the Spanish government to take in these people.
Barcelona's immigration coordinator, Ignacy Calvo, agrees. He says the city received 5,000 of the nearly 60,000 migrants last year. Yet the central government didn't send any extra funds to deal with the influx.
The biggest complaint that cities have is that we are dealing with this alone.
And it's not just the migrants crossing the sea from Africa, Calvo adds. There are people migrating to Barcelona from all over the world. The biggest percent of asylum seekers are actually from Venezuela. Barcelona has doubled the capacity of its homeless shelters, but Calvo says many migrants, including unaccompanied children, still end up living on the streets.
Para Europa y para los estados, la migración no deja de ser una entelequia.
For Europe and European countries, immigration is a political problem. They talk about flows, numbers and quotas, but cities have to deal with the day-to-day reality.
And the flow of migrants could continue to increase. According to the UN Migration Agency, 3,400 migrants have arrived in Spain in the first 3 weeks of this year, three times the number in 2017. For NPR News, I'm Lucia Benavides in Barcelona.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Just ahead, can her past election successes offer insight into how well Senator Elizabeth Warren might do in her presidential campaign? There's a new analysis on this. We take a look. Forecast, very wet day today. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
Look for the rain to become steadier and heavier. Temperatures this afternoon get into the mid-50s. That gusty wind could cause some scattered power outages, 1 to 2 inches of rain. Tonight it all comes to an end. We clear out. We go down to the 20s. It's sunny on Friday, back to the 30s. Saturday sunshine only in the upper 20s, but Sunday it's in the low 40s with a blend of clouds and sun.
Temperatures edging up. We're now at 54 in Boston.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by North Shore Medical Center, offering routine colonoscopies and advanced procedures to diagnose and treat gastrointestinal conditions. nsmc.partners.org. Thompson Family Adventures. Small group and private family adventures around the world, as seen in Travel and Leisure, familyadventures.com/WBUR. And Artist Senior Living of Lexington and Reading, a specialized memory care community for those with dementia, fostering an individualized approach to care. ArtistSeniorLiving.com.
Now, Bostonomics business, Boston-based Vertex Pharmaceuticals, has fired its COO for personal behavior that violated the company's code of conduct. Vertex says the firing of Ian Smith has nothing to do with Vertex's financial and business performance and that the termination was done following an investigation by outside counsel. State Senator Eric Lesser is proposing a bill to pay people to move to Western Mass to work remotely from their homes or from a co-working space. It's modeled after a similar program in Vermont. The Massachusetts version would provide remote workers a grant of up to $10,000 if they live in Hampshire, Hamden, Franklin, or Berkshire counties. To qualify, the employee's business would have to currently be based outside of those four counties. This is WBUR. It's 8:45.
Funding for WBUR's business report comes from Margulies Peruzzi, sharing the results of their workplace strategy study. You can read how expression of an organization's brand within their workplace relates to reinforcing mission and culture at mp-architects.com.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Bob Oakes. With the 2020 presidential campaign heating up, here's a question about candidate Elizabeth Warren. What can Elizabeth Warren's 2018 Senate election results tell us about Elizabeth Warren, the presidential candidate? Knowing who went for Warren in Massachusetts last November and who did not could shine a light on who might vote for her in 2020 and on her strengths and weaknesses. That's according to Nathaniel Rakin, an elections analyst for 538, the data journalism website known for its focus on election polling. Nathaniel joins us in the studio now to talk about this. Thanks for coming in.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
So big picture first. Our listeners might be wondering what can the results of the Senate elections in deep blue Massachusetts really say about the national presidential election in 2020?
So Massachusetts, even though it is generally deep blue, has lots of different pockets, some conservative voters, some liberal voters, different types of liberal voters, more to the point. And you can tell how a candidate's relative performance in, say, the suburbs versus in the city versus in Western Massachusetts can forecast how they'll do in a nationwide primary.
And when you say that, you mean the Massachusetts results might apply anywhere in the country?
Exactly. So Massachusetts, for example, has a few majority-minority cities, and specifically some majority-Black and majority-Hispanic precincts in Boston. And those, for instance, can tell us whether Warren, in this case, is likely to overperform or underperform with those types of voters.
All right. Well, let's pick some of this data apart. You did a side-by-side analysis of Warren's 2018 Senate election results here and Hillary Clinton's 2016 general election presidential bid in Massachusetts. What'd you find?
Relative to Clinton, you saw a few patterns. You saw that Warren underperformed in highly educated, very high-income suburbs of Boston, places like Weston and Wellesley. And at the same time, Warren overperformed in places in western Massachusetts like Hawley, like Wendell, like North Adams that are lower income, less college educated, but also very loyal to this Bernie Sanders slash Elizabeth Warren brand of populism.
Can you see where underperforming in the so-called elite suburbs might be a problem for Warren, considering it was the suburbs that drove so many Democrats to election victory, congressional election victory, in this last race?
For sure. I mean, you don't want to underperform anywhere. That said, I think that it makes sense. You know, Warren's made her entire career about being against big business and wanting to break up the banks, and that kind of message isn't going to resonate in places like elite suburbs. In the general election, I think it's an open question whether antipathy for President Trump is just going to drive these voters toward the Democratic nominee almost regardless of who it is.
What does all this say about Warren's potential to win over voters who might have gone for Obama in 2012, but shunned Clinton in 2016 and went for Bernie Sanders?
Yeah, this I think was the most interesting finding of my analysis. Places that seem to be very Sandersy went for Warren in huge numbers. In many cases, Warren did even better than Obama did in 2012 in these towns in western Massachusetts that I mentioned. That, I think, indicates that Warren, contrary to the conventional wisdom that she might be a more unelectable candidate, is actually really strong with these white working class voters in places like the Midwest that, of course, Hillary Clinton famously lost and Donald Trump won.
And what about people of color in communities that are majority minorities, so to speak, considering that people of color cast 40% of all the votes in the Democratic primary?
In Massachusetts, you kind of saw minority voters being neutral on Warren. They didn't do appreciably better or worse for her than they did for Clinton. A possible exception to this is Hispanic voters. In some of the precincts in Boston where there are a lot of Latinos, like East Boston, you did see Warren do a little bit better than Clinton, but it wasn't a huge difference. So I don't think you can say that Hispanic voters are a part of her base. That said, she doesn't appear to have turned them off, so that could imply that she could at least build upon that constituency in 2020.
Does that make non-white voters a wild card?
Yes, absolutely.
So back to the big picture. Early on in the 2020 race, Senator Warren seems then to be in a pretty good standing compared to how Hillary Clinton performed against Donald Trump, but she has work to do.
Absolutely, she has work to do. It's a very unsettled field. Even if Elizabeth Warren were to win every Bernie Sanders primary voter, of course, that didn't constitute a majority in 2016. It's also worth noting that statewide, Warren ran a little bit behind Clinton and, in fact, did a lot worse than you might expect, given that 2018 was such a Democratic-leaning year and Massachusetts is a Democratic state. You would have expected that Warren would have run a lot ahead of Clinton, but, in fact, they ran about even.
Nathaniel Rakich, thanks very much for coming in. Nathaniel is an elections analyst for the data journalism website 538.
Thanks, Bob.
We love public radio listeners. They're thoughtful, responsible, and care about the world. Most are diehard recyclers. So why not recycle your car to support public radio? It may not fit in the blue bin, but you can donate it to WBUR. We'll get top dollar for it, and you'll be supporting the news. And you could be eligible for a tax deduction. Go to WBUR.org/cars. Thank you.
Coming up on WBUR's Morning Edition, on his way to Panama, Pope Francis addresses several touchy issues, including the border wall, the fear of migration, and refugees. Peter O'Dowd is in now with us to talk about Here and Now at Noon today. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Bob. Well, what are we now? Well, more than a month into this partial government shutdown, workers are about to miss their second paycheck. We're going to speak with a mother from the U.S. Marshals Service in Michigan. She's got three kids. She's missed two paychecks, as I said. She's having trouble getting money for her child support payments. She's gone to food pantries. She's now got a rent payment that is due, and she's not exactly sure where she's going to find the money. A reminder that these are real people and hundreds of thousands of real people who are not getting paid. It's sort of unbelievable.
Real people with real bills.
With real bills. And then the ice storm happened here. I was in Arizona. I got stranded in Arizona for 3 days, and I decided to go.
We all feel really bad.
I was terrible. It was nice and sunny. But I went down to the border just because I had to do something. I went down to the border, and I did interviews with people there. I met up with the Santa Cruz County Sheriff in Nogales. We talked about the border wall. We talked about the crisis that's what the president's calling it. He says the real crisis is the drugs coming over, not the humanitarian crisis, but the drugs coming over. And we talk about how that plays out right there on the border where there's already a fence.
All right. Peter O'Dowd back with those conversations and stories and more on Here and Now at noon today. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Pope Francis is in Central America. He's in Panama to attend the Catholic Church's World Youth Day. While traveling, the Pope was asked about the wall that President Trump wants to build on the border with Mexico. And the Pope responded by saying, "It is fear that makes us crazy." Inés San Martín of the Catholic news site Crux Now is traveling with the Pope, and she's on the line. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
The Pope must have known when he decided to take questions from reporters that somebody was going to ask him about the wall since he was heading to Latin America.
Yeah, technically at this time, I mean, the way it works, it's on the outbound flight to where he's going. The Pope doesn't actually take questions. He just greets all of us, and we try to sneak in a question. What happened this time was an Italian journalist who was recently in Tijuana say, you know, I've seen the border. It goes all the way to the ocean, the wall that has already been built, and it's crazy. And the Pope said, yes. It's fear that makes us crazy. He actually fielded questions on a lot of issues, but all of them were kind of on the quiet side.
On the quiet side, except for this remark. So he was responding to a view or an opinion that was expressed by an Italian journalist. Was this unusual?
Not really. Because, I mean, personally, for instance, I told him that an Iraqi bishop, the New York Bishop of Mosul, told me that they're waiting for the Pope, and the Pope said, hey, I'd love to come. It's the bishop who told me not to. So it's not all that unusual that the Pope has a comment to say, especially in the past he's talked about nuclear war. He's talked about how he's afraid for the Korean Peninsula. So it's just, do we journalists get together at the end of the papal greeting to exchange what he said or not? Sometimes journalists decide that it's private. Sometimes we share it because we want to get the story out.
How does the Pope's remark about the wall fit with his other statements about President Trump over the last few years?
They're kind of expected. Although, I mean, it's worth noting that the wall the journalist was talking about has been there. It was built before the Trump administration.
Oh, yeah. It's a steel fence. It goes down into the ocean at Tijuana, between Tijuana and San Diego. Absolutely.
Right. But we've heard the Pope before say, he who builds walls is not a Christian. He was, of course, referring to Trump because Trump was the question, but he was also referring to what's going on across Europe. We have very Catholic countries such as Poland building up fences to keep migrants off their country. So it's definitely aligned to what he said with Trump before, and it's also aligned to what he said about migration in general. We obviously, you know, Trump right now is in the news because he's the president of the U.S., but when it comes to Pope Francis and migration, being that he's a son of migrants himself, he's always been very, a very strong advocate to, we need to help these people who are fleeing hunger or violence. And when you see, what's happening in Nicaragua right now, I was there in November for 2 weeks. I understand why people want to flee their country. The problem is, how do we deal with it? How do we address it? How do we help these people?
What is the Pope's official purpose in being in Panama?
He is attending, as you said, a Catholic event called World Youth Day, which is a youth gathering that takes place every 2 or 3 years in different cities. Last time we had it was in 2016 when he went to Krakow in Poland. That is the official reason for his visit. Obviously, one can understand that the Vatican chose Panama for various reasons, including the fact that it's often seen as a bridge between the north and the south, the west and the southern hemisphere. And he's definitely going to be talking about that during some of his speeches in the next 4 days.
Ines San Martin is a reporter for Crux Now and is traveling with Pope Francis in Central America. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
Zimbabwe has lost one of its most beloved voices. His name is Oliver Mtukudzi, and he died yesterday at the age of 66. The musician was one of the few constants in a country that's been through a lot and faces an uncertain political future. Here's NPR's Andrew Limbong.
Outside Zimbabwe, Oliver Mtukudzi's style of music is described as jazz or world. But in Zimbabwe, Mtukudzi was so big, people just refer to it by his nickname, Tuku music. It's a mix of various types of traditional Zimbabwean music, blended with Western rock and pop, whatever he heard as a kid. His career began in the late 1970s, when he used that music to talk about the white minority rule in his country, then known as Rhodesia. Mtukudzi told NPR in 2002 that this song was written as a message.
If you translate it literally, it says, hit the drum, Mtavara, hit it hard so that everybody else can hear and can follow your tune. But the actual meaning then wasn't like hit the drum, it was like take your arm and fight.
Mtukudzi steered clear from naming names. He wanted his music to live on beyond specific people and events, but he did address the crisis of HIV and AIDS directly in his music.
What shall we do?
The song in particular deals with issues of sexual violence and gender roles within the HIV and AIDS crisis in Zimbabwe and elsewhere. In 2013, he said he just wanted to open the conversation.
It's a song that was full of questions with no solution at all. And all those questions started making people talk about the disease and try and take the stigma away from it.
Throughout his career, Oliver Mtukudzi released more than 60 albums and toured the world despite personal tragedy. His son and collaborator Sam died in a car accident in 2010. Oliver Mtukudzi saw music as a way to relieve grief and diffuse tension. It wasn't about forgetting your problems, but giving a reason to dance in the face of them. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Forecast says a rainy, windy day today, but at least on the mild side, it'll be in the 50s today. We have some heavy rain coming this afternoon, but then tonight it blows out, clears, and drops to the 20s. Sunny skies tomorrow in the mid-30s. The weekend, sunny on Saturday and in the 20s, partly sunny in the 40s on Sunday. In Boston now, 54 degrees. This is WBUR. The BBC is next.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up today on Point, a no-call, blown call by officials cost the Saints a chance to go to the Super Bowl. We'll look at the NFL under fire again. Plus, what if the way we think about freedom and equality is all wrong? A philosopher makes the case and lays out how to have more of both. That's on Point this morning from 10 to noon on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
From Boston University, you're listening to 90.9 WBUR FM Boston, home of Boston's largest radio newsroom. 92.7 WBUA Tisbury, 89.1 WBUH Brewster, and streaming at WBUR.org. WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.